I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Nearly 50% of Kansas City, Missourians live in rental properties, and more than 23,000 tenants report having maintenance issues with their homes. Now a Harvard researcher who knows Kansas City well is beginning her work organizing tenants and educating them about their rights. Could a new renters power group help address the lack of affordable housing in town and reduce evictions in the process? Later, he climbed rock walls so high your head would spin. Today we'll learn how one thrill seeker is using his adventures to educate people about the world's unexplored environments. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Just short of 50% of the population of Kansas City, Missouri lives in rental housing. Meantime, more than 23,000 tenants say they have one or more severe housing conditions, such as lack of complete kitchens, inadequate plumbing, or serious overcrowding. In some poorer neighborhoods, more than 4 in 10 renters say they had outstanding maintenance issues. Stepping into the breach could be a new tenant power organization that's just getting organized. With us here to talk about this new group is its organizer, Tara Raghuveer, who's also been researching the eviction issue in Kansas City. Tara, it's nice to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Steve.
You know, why does the city need a new tenant power organization, and what would it do exactly?
So the national housing crisis has not skipped over Kansas City. As you said, half the people in this city are tenants, and many of them have issues with their housing. It would take 2.5 full-time minimum wage jobs for a working person to afford a two-bedroom apartment in Kansas City. And that's not to speak of all of the issues with housing that you mentioned in your introduction. So the urgency around starting this organization now is that poor folks, workers, people of color can still afford to live in Kansas City and for the most part haven't been totally displaced. But if we wait 5 years to make a bold intervention, they will be displaced and we won't have people of color, workers, and poor folks able to live in our city anymore.
Because you see prices rising potentially that much the next few years.
I think that's right. And we don't have to look far to see examples in other cities of what this looks like, right? Seattle, Denver are cities that just years ago would not have been considered unaffordable for a working class. And now, within a matter of years, have transformed. And the working class has been totally displaced to the outer ring suburbs or far beyond.
Do you think your organization could actually achieve lower rents?
I think the first project is building a base of impacted tenants. One of the other reasons we're doing this now is, you know, housing has kind of become this hot topic in town. Electeds are talking about it. People like you and people at the publications in town are writing about housing.
Right.
But there's a voice that's missing from the conversation, and that voice is the voice of people who are actually impacted. So my theory of change is that the people closest to the problem are the closest to the solution. And until those people are at the table and at the center of making the policies that will better their lives, we actually can't put forward any of our own proposals because they're not based in reality.
So what are you up against here, Tara, as you try to organize folks who I imagine are tough to organize? How do you go about this?
It is tough work. I'm a national organizer, and I've been running a housing justice campaign nationally for about 2 years now. Organizing tenants is inherently extremely difficult because of the challenges that poor communities face, right? Tenants, especially those who have housing insecurity, are moving all the time because they fall behind on rent, because their properties aren't up to standards, because they're unsafe communities. So it's a tough community to organize, certainly. And just this week, I've got a couple organizers on the doors in a few of the communities that we know are hotspots for evictions or bad housing. But what we're encouraged about is that at the doors, what we've heard, even just in the last few days, is that tenants in Kansas City are fed up and they're ready to organize.
They're on the edge anyway.
they're on the edge.
So are you connected with a national organization then?
No, as of now, this is a Kansas City-based project. I mean, mm-hmm. I myself am connected to a national organization.
And what is it?
It's People's Action. It's a national grassroots organizing group.
Mm-hmm. Based in Washington?
No, based in Chicago.
Based in Chicago. Who funds them and what are they about?
So it's a group with a long history actually organizing on housing. Historically, it was known as National People's Action, and the founders of NPA were neighborhood organizers in Chicago who won the first big structural reforms around housing nationwide. So things like the Community Reinvestment Act and the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, we owe thanks to the organizing work that was done by NPA back in the day, the mm-hmm. communities across the country that understood that local wins were good, but they weren't going to add up into a sum total of structural reform that was needed. So that's a little bit about the group. It's a multi-issue organizing network, and we organize on issues like climate change and criminal justice reform as well.
And what's the name of your local organization that's working with tenants out there?
The working name right now is KC Tenants. We have some social media.
That's so creative, Tara.
Well, I say working name because I do really believe in the idea that this organization will be successful insofar as directly impacted folks are in leadership and making decisions about strategic things like what we call ourselves. So KC Tenants is the sort of easiest name right now.
Right.
But the leadership team that we recruit in may decide that they want to be known as something else in a few months.
So once this group gets up and going, what do you hope it becomes? What's the long game? What's the ambition here for what this group could be someday?
The vision is that this group becomes a powerful political force in town. In many other cities in this country, there's a long history of tenant organizing and poor people organizing. And in Kansas City, we have some of that, some beautiful examples of what can happen when folks are organized around their self-interest. Organizing is about changing the conditions of what's possible.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, what is possible is that Kansas City in 5 years is unaffordable to a working class. What is possible is that we sell the city over to big out-of-state developers. What is possible is that we have yogurt shops and $5 coffees on every block, but we don't have any people of color who can afford to live in this city anymore. That's all possible, but it's not inevitable. So the vision for this organization is that we build enough power among people who are impacted to demand a massive change and a massive change now.
We're talking here about a new organization aiming to organize tenants in Kansas City. We want to hear from Kansas City renters. Do you have an interest in joining a group concerned with renters' issues? Our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So, Tara, what are you hearing out there from renters? What kinds of stories are and what kinds of challenges are these folks up against every day?
I have a couple stories for you. I've been talking to tenants for the better part of 2 years. My research in Kansas City extends back 6 years, and for 2 years, I've been getting calls to my personal cell phone from folks who are experiencing eviction or other housing struggles. And then more recently, as I've relocated back to Kansas City full-time, I've had the opportunity to build some relationships with some of the folks who are going to be in leadership of this organization. One of those people is a woman named Tiana Caldwell, and Tiana was re-diagnosed with ovarian cancer about 6 months ago, and as a product of her cancer diagnosis, fell behind on her rent. Mm. So she and her husband and their 11-year-old son, AJ, were evicted from their unit. And with an eviction on their record, it became increasingly difficult to find a decent place to live. So they finally found a place that's owned by an out-of-state landlord, and they moved in, and on the first night, they took showers, and sewage came out of the pipes. Mm. And Tiana and Derek tried calling their landlord and the management company for 2 weeks. No one came out. So eventually, they called the health department, and the health department effectively evicted them again. And since that
time— Because the place was unsafe.
It was uninhabitable, especially with Tiana's lowered immune system during her treatments. So since that time, they've been living in a hotel in Kansas City, paying upwards of $300 a week.
Mm.
So they're essentially experiencing homelessness, and homelessness is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Both Tiana and Derek work, and they have two incomes, meaning that they can't qualify for a shelter or public assistance, but they also can't rent because no one will rent to them with an eviction on their record.
Huh. You had another story there, too, it sounds like.
I do. So this week I spoke to a woman named Deborah who lives in, or who lived rather, in an apartment in the 18th and Vine district. And she was asked to sign a lease that held her accountable for the mold in her building. And it also held her accountable for standing up on a chair and checking her smoke detector once a week. Deborah is a senior who is certainly not going to stand up on a chair and risk her life to check the smoke detector, nor was she comfortable being held responsible for mold in a building that she doesn't own. So she tried to opt out of sections of her lease, and her landlord retaliated against her and evicted her. So for a month, she too had to move all of her belongings into storage and live out of a pretty unsafe hotel.
So the horror stories you would hear anywhere in this country, you're saying, are happening right here in Kansas City.
That's right. And Steve, I've been listening to some of your interviews with the mayoral candidates. One thing that struck me is everyone is talking about this renaissance in Kansas City that's happened in the last 8 years.
Right.
And I think the question we have to ask is, renaissance for whom?
Right. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. We're talking about tenant rights in this community. How can they stand up to landlords who may be taking advantage of them? 816-235-2888. Let's go to Victor from the Plaza area. Victor, you're on the air.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Tara. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a minister on the Plaza area, and the comment that I wanted to make is that a vast majority of the people who come to me in crisis often come to me in regards to housing. And when a renter gets behind because of jobs or, you know, financial issues, it's not just the rent they owe, but it's also any fees that the landlord has deemed, you know, a late fee or something like that, and also any court costs. And also, the landlords often will not accept just a check. They force them to go to the bank to get, for example, a bank draft or a teller's check, which also has fees. So it can snowball on someone very, very quickly.
That gets the whole idea that it's costly to be poor sometimes, Tara.
It's costly to be poor. And the other part of what I'm hearing and what you've shared, Victor, and what I've heard from tenants is that the flip side of the cost of being poor is that there's a profit in evictions. There's a profit in a whole industry built to exploit people in their most desperate moments, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Victor, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. In fact, Tara, your website for the Kansas City Eviction Project says this, and I'm quoting, "The consistency in eviction filings year over year in Kansas City suggests that there may be a core of landlords in the city for whom eviction is part of their business model." Tell us about that. When you say it's part of their business model, what are you talking about there?
Actually, Victor just said it perfectly, right? When some landlords, and I'm not talking about all landlords, but when some landlords rent to especially low-income renters and renters who are evidently vulnerable in other ways, maybe they're undocumented immigrants, maybe they're single mothers, maybe they have a criminal history, there are some landlords who select into that market because they know they can turn a profit. And what that looks like is someone might be fall behind in a given month, which is very typical in those kinds of communities. And the landlord will have already collected on their deposit. They'll already have collected on past month's rent. They might take them to eviction court or they might just kick them out. And that landlord knows they can fill that unit the next night, right? Mm-hmm. And the landlord can also create a profit based on the fees associated with the eviction or the complaint that they file. So there are all sorts of ways that I've heard about from landlords directly and from tenants and from the courts about how people can profit off of this kind of horrific business model.
You know, how many other cities have groups like KC Tenants, this organization you're in the process of putting together?
Many. There's a long...
Not unusual.
Not at all. There's a long and storied history of tenant organizing across the country. One of my favorite stories, actually, is that Jane Fonda's favorite, her famous workout videos initially were meant to underwrite a nationwide tenant organizing campaign. So a lot of the money made from the Jane Fonda tapes back in the day helped to fund some of the first fights for rent regulations and tenant organizing in places like New Jersey and California and everywhere in between.
You know, should I be surprised that given the fact that half the people in Kansas City are renters, I'm surprised there hasn't been a tenant rights organization until now?
I'm not that surprised.
Yeah.
I think in a city like Kansas City, until very recently, we might have been a little lazy in assuming that this is an affordable city. I've heard that a lot.
That's the reputation.
That's the reputation. And I think when I started to talk to people about my eviction research 6 years ago and even 2 years ago, I'm often met with shock about the numbers. I found that 42 people per business day are evicted through the formal process alone. That doesn't account for all the evictions that happen outside of the courts and with no data to represent them.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when I present that number, people are shocked. They're horrified because a lot of the evictions that happen in Kansas City and a lot of the abuses within housing happen outside of the line of sight for most people of privilege in the city, and it's not part of our civic conversation. And
right.
And I should say, too, that's by design, right? We have to remember our historical context in this city, wherein it was built to segregate Black communities, poor communities in one part of town under thoroughfares and in communities that no one else drives to. And that's that history has played out.
Is that what led you to this work, Tara, these years you spent doing research here in town? And you've said that this city has a rich treasure trove of data now that you can look at to figure out exactly what's going on out there.
That's right. It's certainly one of my motivations. I have a data set of evictions in Jackson County that spans almost 20 years. It's 200,000 eviction records. They're all at the address level. And I've spent the past 6 years doing analysis of that data. And I think the conclusion that I've come to more recently in the past year or so is that I could spend the next decade working with that data set alone and answering interesting questions. And that would be wrong. That would be a mistake, because by now we know enough to know that we need to do something. And that something, clearly I'm biased because I'm an organizer by training, but I think that something is organizing the people who are impacted to demand a different outcome.
You know, one thing you found is that race impacts who gets evicted in this city. Do I have that right?
That's right. And it's not only that race impacts who gets evicted, it's that race is the biggest predictor of whether or not you will be evicted in Kansas City.
Let's go to some phone calls here again, 816-235-2888. We're talking about a new tenant power organization designed to represent tenants in this town against landlords. Tara Raghuveer is my guest. Let's go back to some calls. And Lauren from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Lauren. Go ahead.
I am a commercial real estate broker, and I think you're absolutely right as it comes to evictions, but also as with market rent just going through the roof. With multifamily, every broker has a list of at least 5 to 10 out-of-state investors who desperately want to buy multifamily buildings, and the trend is to buy a building that's what you would call like a C building, make a few upgrades to bring it to a B building, and increase your rents. And what's happened in downtown and the Crossroads with, you know, $1,800 for 700 square feet sort of thing, that is definitely going to start expanding into areas like Midtown, like the Northeast, like Raytown, where people do have affordable rent, and we need a way to protect that so that we're not displacing large groups of people, because we want more retail development for, like she mentioned, expensive coffees and yogurts. So I think another important aspect is not only not evicting people, but also protecting the building that they live in from new ownership and it becoming unaffordable for them.
So, Lauren, this idea of organizing tenants makes sense to you?
It does, and I think it would also work towards actually protecting the building or the plot, something that would legally protect these people from essentially an investment strategy,
right,
of someone,
right,
who doesn't live here.
Lauren, I got to scoot down, but I appreciate your phone call very much. Thank you. Let's go to Rachel from the historic Northeast neighborhood. Rachel, good morning.
Hi, Steve. My daughter and I just lost our apartment when we opted to move out on very, very short notice when the new landlords refused to deal with a bed bug issue. In fact, they were going to charge me to exterminate the bed bugs, but only in my unit. They weren't even going to do a good job. And if I hadn't been dating an attorney and didn't have access to people who could help me hire a moving company, I would be in a lot different position than I am now.
So you saw the bed bugs, Rachel, and you decided to get the heck out then.
Yes, I saw the bed bugs and contacted the new property manager. And the new landlord, I didn't even know who they were. It was just some generic LLC. And could not get a hold of anyone. My daughter and I were staying with friends. We ended up staying with friends for 2 months while I looked for a new place.
And Tara, as Rachel was saying, she couldn't even figure out who the landlord was. You were nodding your head, and you recognize that.
Yeah, pattern. Absolutely. And Rachel, before I let you go, you should email me at tara@kctenants.org. And any other tenants who are interested in getting involved, please do the same. The trend of out-of-state investors speculating in real estate markets like Kansas City is national. And we've seen a huge uptick in this, especially since the 08 crisis when homes were foreclosed. And, you know, to the point that we heard from the real estate broker who called in, it became a business model, actually a strategy. And there were webinars across the world about what it would look like to invest in formerly foreclosed properties in places like Kansas City. This is predatory, right? Mm. It's an extraction economy that makes money actually for people who don't live in Kansas City. They often don't live in the state of Missouri. They often don't even live in the United States. Hmm. One of the biggest evictors that I've identified in our data set is a company that's based out of Israel, and it's private equity money that's held in New York. And they evicted 300 people in 2018 in Kansas City.
Hmm. Rachel, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Let's go to Jack from Kansas City, Missouri. Jack, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My point was, when we organize or when we do anything to improve tenant conditions, the landlords raise the rent. And then just like my rent went up $50 after the bill that just passed in the Missouri legislature.
Hmm. Okay. What is happening in the legislature, Tara?
So unfortunately, Missouri is a state where some of the wins that we might aspire to at the municipal level are preempted. Mm-hmm. There was a wave of preemption regulation in states around the country in the 90s that preempts states like Missouri from implementing rent control or rent regulation at the municipal level. That's unfortunate, but I do think there are things that we can fight for and win at the city level to protect people like Jack from retaliation from his landlord in the event that he organizes. So, for example, and this is kind of related to what the real estate broker was saying too, we should have a tenant bill of rights in Kansas City that protects renters from retaliation when they try to organize for better conditions. That bill of rights can also include a right of first refusal if their property is going to be sold, giving the tenants of that property the right to organize and refuse the buyer if they're not comfortable with someone from out of state having control of their home.
Tell us again how folks can get a hold of you going forward as we wind up here, Tara.
Sure thing. My email is Tara, T-A-R-A, at kctenants.org. And soon we'll have a live website and Facebook page and Twitter at kctenants.
Okay. We'll stay in touch. Tara Raghuveer, who's been researching the eviction issue in Kansas City, her group again, tentatively called KC Tenants. Thanks for visiting with us. Appreciate
it. Thanks so much, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk to one of the world's greatest rock climbers. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke with Terrence Wise, the stand-up KC leader who testified in Washington in favor of raising the federal minimum wage. You can hear that and other previous conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, how has investing in downtown had a positive effect on surrounding neighborhoods? We'll ask the city manager about that and future developments in the metro. City Manager Troy Schulte will be here tomorrow on KCUR's Up-to-Date. Well, for many years, Mark Sinnott was a climber. Big, steep rock walls that seemed to go on forever. These are walls that most reasonable people would regard as impassable. At some point, Sinnott took a hard look at his exploits and began to wonder if this was really what he wanted to be doing. So he searched for a way to transform his passion for climbing into a public good. We're about to find out what he came up with. Mark Sinnott is an adventure writer for National Geographic and the author of The Impossible Climb, which tells of Alex Hanold's unprecedented 3,000-foot vertical climb up El Capitan in Yosemite without a rope. His work has appeared in National Geographic magazine, Men's Journal, Outside, and New York magazine. And he joins us now via Skype. Mark, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Steve.
You know, I know you get this question all the time, but why do you guys climb these things? I mean, you put your life on the line every single time. Maybe that's the point, but why did you do it?
Well, it's been kind of an evolving thing, I guess you could say, because, you know, it started out sort of in one place when I was 15, and I'm 49 now, and you know, I'm still climbing. I'm, you know, not as crazy as I was when I was when I was a youth. I think it might be fair to say that nobody has ever answered your question well.
Right.
I think we all struggle to explain why we do it. One thing I've said in the past is that the very first time that I rock climbed, I got this feeling where all the kind of craziness that I had in my head went quiet.
Yeah.
And I think the reason is because I didn't realize this at the time, but when you're hanging on the side of a cliff, you have no choice but to be so focused on on the moment in which you're in.
Yeah.
That all the other, you know, noise that we have inside of us tends to go away. And so I found kind of a peace when I was climbing, even though I was doing something dangerous. And, you know, that drew me in. And it's still there, you know, it's still a big part of it.
Yeah.
Today.
No, you said when you were younger, you were a little crazier. What were some of the crazy things you did as a climber that you look back on now and you wonder, what in the world was I thinking?
Well, I kind of wish that I was still doing stuff like this nowadays. Really? And I haven't completely ruled it out, you know, that I might have, you know, kind of a swan song here. And I am actually going to Everest in April. So,
no kidding.
So the journey continues. But as you referenced, you know, in my intro, my specialty as a climber has always been what we call big wall climbing. And so a big wall is defined simply as a cliff that's so big that it takes you more than one day to get to the top. So a big wall is a cliff in which you have to sleep on the side of the wall on the way up to the top. And one of the walls that I climbed when I was, you know, I think like 25, 26 was in Baffin Island, which was in Arctic Canada.
Right.
And that one took us 39 days. And so we slept in this contraption called the Portal Edge, which is a hanging cot with straps coming off the four corners that attach to a single point.
Yep.
And we had three guys inside of that thing. We had two guys in the top, and then we had one guy underneath hanging under it in a hammock. And we were on an Arctic big wall, you know, for 39 days. It's how long it took us to get to the top.
You know, I've seen pictures of guys doing that, and it's mostly guys. I guess some women do it too. But do you actually sleep in that thing, or are you so scared you never close your eyes all night?
You know, that's a pretty common question that I get, Steve. And what I tell people is, and this would hold bear for you, true for you too, if you and I went and did one of these climbs, you know, you're gonna work your way up to doing this kind of thing like a normal person, right? You're not gonna just go from 0 to 60. So you're gonna do small climbs. You're going to work your way up through the ranks. And by the time you get to doing a big wall, you have enough experience as a climber that it actually seems normal when you sleep on your on the cliff. It might be kind of thrilling, but at that point, you completely trust all of the safety systems and the rigging and that kind of stuff. So you don't have any kind of fear, you know, that things are going to let loose on you or anything. And the other thing is just that
even when the wind's blowing up there and you're shaking around and you're feeling okay.
I mean, I've had some crazy ones for sure. We've experienced this thing that we call the Bronco ride, which is when, you know, picture a really strong wind in the mountains coming, you know, up a valley, and then it just runs straight into a giant cliff. Mm-hmm. It's going to go up, and it creates these updrafts, which can be incredibly powerful. Sometimes they can lift you in the air. Mm. And the Bronco ride is when you're in the portal edge and the updrafts are so strong that it's lifting the portal edge up in the air. We also called it the magic carpet ride because when the updraft is hitting, the portal edge is actually levitating in the air. It's a crazy feeling. The problem is that eventually the gust dies and then the ledge drops and it slams back into the wall. And I had a climb where it slammed into the wall so many times that it eventually tore through the rain fly that we had over. And then the wind came in and it tore it all up. And the storm came in and we were in the bed of the portal edge and it started filling up like a bathtub. So we were laying in a pool of ice water way up on this cliff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think most people wouldn't enjoy too much.
Oh, man. Mark Sinnott will speak about life on the vertical at 7:30 Tuesday evening at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets at kauffmancenter.org. You know, you just said a few minutes ago that you've got some more adventures in you, and I'm wondering to what extent you have been inspired by your old climbing partner, Alex Hanold. I mentioned in the opening, he just completed, and I just saw the documentary on this, just breathtaking story of his 3,000-foot climb up El Capitan in Yosemite without a rope. It was the first time it was ever done. You've written a book about this. Has he inspired you that you want to climb Everest and maybe even try some other things?
He has, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think anybody that knows Alex finds inspiration in him. One of the reasons that I felt motivated to write the book is that I felt like I understood Alex pretty well. I took him on his first four international climbing expeditions when he first came up through the ranks. We're both members of a thing called the North Face Global Athlete Team. So we're professional climbers and our job is to like go out and do first ascents and that kind of thing. And so that's how Alex and I first joined up. And he, you know, I watched his whole process as he, became essentially the most famous climber in the world. And what I noticed was that people didn't really understand him. And they, there was this thing going on where people were kind of writing him off and they were just saying that he was a freak. And there was speculation that there was something wrong with his brain. In particular, people said that he had a defective amygdala, which is kind of a fear processing unit, you know, deep inside our brains.
Right.
And I knew that it wasn't true because I'd climbed with him and I'd seen him get scared. And what I knew is that he had actually been working on this decades long process of learning how to control fear, mm-hmm. you know, and it's one of our most basic primal emotions. And I think we would all love to be able to have control over something like that. I think we all fear it. All of us, you know, we fear all kinds of different things, whatever it is, whether it's your wife being unfaithful or for us falling off a cliff or maybe even death. Alex went about this process of teaching himself to suppress that feeling when it comes over him. And what he told me is that he started thinking about fear. He said, "Why can't I treat fear like hunger?" So when we get hungry, like maybe you get hungry right now and you haven't had lunch yet, but you think, well, I'm working, so I can't eat right now. So I'm not just going to sit here and dwell on the fact that I'm hungry. I'm going to just put that out of my mind.
Right.
Now, and we're all pretty good at doing that kind of thing. And Alex said, well, why can't I do that with fear? Why do I have to get this whole panic response and have my heart rate spiking and all that kind of stuff. So he started working on it slowly but surely. And that was the key element in this climb that he did, because physically he was capable of that climb. And there's a lot of people that are capable of it, but there's no one else in the world that's capable of doing it without a rope. And the reason why he is and was capable of doing it is because he learned to take that panicky feeling and just press it back down and say, nope.
Can you give us a little context here about his climb? Just how extraordinary was what he pulled off there?
Well, the New York Times said, I think that it was one of the greatest athletic feats ever, I think, was their wording. It's one of those things where it's hard for a non-climber to appreciate, what Alex did.
Right.
But, El Capitan, some people have probably been to Yosemite. It's basically the most important cliff in the world. As you said, it's 3,000 feet tall. It's vertical and overhanging. 3,000 feet is a long way for a vertical face. Mm-hmm. And the route that he did, it has all of these crazy, crux climbing sections. One of the most difficult for him was a spot about 600 feet up where it was a slab. And so picture the rock about 80 degrees. So take a vertical wall, tilt it back 10 degrees, and then imagine that it's perfectly blank and smooth like a piece of glass. Mm. And the way that you go up it is with the type of climbing that we call friction climbing, where you're not actually grabbing on anything. You're just putting your palms against the rock and you try to smear, we call it, with your rock shoes. You try to put as much rubber as you can, and you're just kind of balanced there. And you try to you try to go up the wall kind of like a gecko, but we're not geckos, right? So we don't have those crazy little hairs or whatever it is that come out of their their appendages.
Yeah.
And that part, it messed with Alex so bad because there was nothing to pull on, and he had to have this perfect poise and balance. Some of the other parts.
I mean, you're scaring me as you describe it. You're scaring me. I mean, I'm getting nervous hearing you describe it.
So a week before he went for the ultimate climb, he said, "Hey, do you want to go up there with me? I'm doing another training session." And this is when we would go with a rope, and he's practicing the moves, and he's trying to get himself in the mindset okay, I'm going to do this without a rope in a few days. Is it cool? Can I do this? And that day that I went up there with him, he slipped on that move. Yeah. And as he slipped off, he kind of grabbed onto a little sling hanging out of the wall, and he sort of stopped himself. And so I was down below, and I didn't even know that he fell because he didn't come on the rope, and I couldn't see him because he was over a rise. Mm-hmm. And then when I got up to where he was, I said, "Well, how'd it go, dude?" And he said, "Yeah, not good. I'm grumpy."
Wow.
And I said, "Well, how come?" And he said, "Yeah." He's like, "I slipped again." And we did the calculations, and he had done that move about 30 times, and he slipped about 3 times. So that sounds like about a 10% chance of slipping off. And I think most people wouldn't really be willing to put their life on the line, for a 10% chance.
Hey, I just got 30 seconds left. You still want to do Everest. Why? Just because it's Everest, Mark? What's your thinking there?
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a journalist and a writer, and I work for National Geographic. So we've come up with what we think is a pretty extraordinary Everest story. So the reason I'm going to Everest is for storytelling and journalism, but it also gives me the excuse to have a go at maybe making it to the summit.
Yeah.
And, as a career climber who's never done that kind of thing, I can't tell you how many thousands of times people have asked me about Everest, and I'm always like, no, and all the climbs I've done are weird, obscure
and they discount
things,
you so. As a result, right? They just dismiss you.
And they might a little bit, So maybe I can finally go, know what? It's pretty cool.
Well, Mark, I'll look forward to reading that story, hearing about your adventures. Mark Sinnott's my guest, and he's part of National Geographic Live Presents. Mark Sinnott, Climber, Life on the Vertical, Tuesday night, 7:30 at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. I always get a kick out of talking to the National Geographic guys. Mark, and your book, The Impossible Climb, thanks so much for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot, Steve.
Be
Best
safe, Mark. You bet.
See ya.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and some cool stuff to do on your weekend.
Her kisses taste like whiskey, burning through my veins. She don't know how to miss me. She hits right where she aims. Baby's got my number and she's calling me up. No.
Okay, look who's here. Brian McTavish with some neat stuff to do on the weekend. And one of those neat things is Blake Shelton. Welcome back.
Yeah.
Nice to have you.
Yeah, it's great to be right here with you in
yes.
the room. Yeah.
Blake Shelton.
Wonderful. Blake Shelton, country music superstar.
Yes, he is.
He's on his Friends and Heroes concert tour. 7 o'clock stop Friday night at Sprint Center downtown. It actually kicks off tonight. This whole big tour he's doing kicks off tonight in Oklahoma City.
Ah.
So we're going to get him early in the game. Now, it's called the Friends and Heroes Tour at Friday night at Sprint Center because Blake Shelton will have his friends and heroes on stage with him.
Good for him.
Like, yeah, really? Isn't that nice? He can kind of, you know, do a little payback. Like the Bellamy brothers are part of the show. Do you remember? Well, let me ask you this. Do you remember 1976 very well?
Oh, stop it.
I remember
yes.
it like it was yesterday. That's
yes.
That's part of my appeal and part of
yes.
my problem.
Yes.
Anyway, the Bellamy brothers, Let Your Love Flow. They're going to do that. Remember that one? Everybody sang along to that
yeah,
in high
sure.
school. You bet they did. John Anderson will join Blake on stage. He does Swingin', you know, that front porch romance thing.
Yeah.
And Trace Adkins. Okay, Trace Adkins has to show up and hopefully sing with Blake, Honky Tonk Badonkadonk.
Okay.
And special guest Lauren Elena, whose biggest hit so far in country radio land has been Road Less Traveled, and she's a former runner-up on American Idol.
A lot of special guests.
A lot of special guests, not to mention Blake being charismatic and handsome, and the ladies love him, and I love him, and he'll do I'll Name the Dogs, and Boys Round Here, and oh, the straight-up and
okay.
steamy Turning Me On. Okay, indeed.
What do we have here?
What happens before the first date?
What does happen?
These days, you might get
Nothing
online.
Happens.
You might try to find somebody online, right? Well, how about...
I don't get that online.
Though. I don't get it, and I don't want to know about it,
yeah,
but
I
don't want to be closed-minded either. It's so complicated. Anyway, Saturday speed dating. Remember, that's almost old-fashioned now. 7 o'clock Saturday at the Ainsworth in Leawood, and this offers you the opportunity to... sit down with people for 5 or 6 minutes.
I can't imagine.
Well, but
I cannot imagine.
But at least you get to be close up and the pheromones might be happening. It's not about finding the perfect person at these things.
You're just looking for someone that maybe you might have a good time with.
Wow, that's exactly right.
I summarized it very briefly. Succinctly.
That's outstanding, actually. So it's not about finding that true love. It's just about, as you said, finding somebody you'd like to spend a little bit more time with. So give it a try. 7 o'clock Saturday night.
I'm not going to give it a try.
You can't. You're a married man.
Yes, I am.
That's right.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 wonderful ways to mingle in Kansas City this weekend. You'll find it at kcur.org. What do we have here?
Cosplay is a good time.
What is cosplay? Remind everybody.
Costume play. That's where if you have a fan favorite character from TV, movies, books, comics, anime,
you
dress up like him. But hey, get this. Cosplay contest prizes and trivia for ages 11 to 18. It's kid cosplay at the Teen Cosplay Ball from 7 to 10 Saturday at the Kansas City Public Library Plaza Branch. Now, parents can't get into the ball.
And oh, really?
They close the doors at 8.
Wow.
Right? So as Spider-Man is getting to know Batgirl and so on and so forth, Doctor Who meet Deadpool.
The parents won't be there to help.
Yes, but if you really wanted to go all in with your kids, you can wait in the lobby and you can come as your favorite crazy whatever it might be.
Or you can dress up and get in.
Well, it's a free country.
If you're an adult.
Well, no, you can't get in.
Oh, okay.
But you can. I'm just suggesting hobnobbing with other people who can't get in of a certain age in your own favorite nutty costume. That's all.
And this is Saturday night.
Saturday from 7 to 10. Have fun.
Okay.
Cosplay is a good time.
I recognize that group.
Okay, let's
hear it. They were good.
Well, let's hear it, expert man. No, who's that?
The Doors.
Oh, that's not the Stones.
No.
Oh, okay.
It's the Doors.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, he says, who is the lead singer? Jim Morrison, right?
Jim Morrison,
so
right.
Jimmy way back when is singing, hey, I got up this morning and got myself a beer. Okay, technically, the Doors to KC Beer Company in Waldo open at 11. So, you can start the ball rolling at 11 if you don't drink and drive. If you take an Uber, right, as if it needs to be said, but let me say it. But if you stick around till 1, from 1 to 5 Saturday at KC Beer Company in Waldo, you can drink beer and get to know some new people at the 5th Anniversary Beer Festival at KC Beer Company.
Wow.
Right, 24 small batch specialty beers. You can sample them, not too many, just the right amount. You get a 7-ounce souvenir glass to take home. And I'll say it again, don't drink and drive. And as if it needs to be said, bring breath mints. definitely bring those.
Good tip from Brian McTavish there.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, and finally today. Okay, let's wrap this up. What's this? There's something Valentine's here.
Well, come on, it's Valentine's Day. You seem awfully anxious to get rid of me today.
No, I'm just watching the clock. Yeah.
Well, is that what you're doing?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I thought you were looking at a bird outside the window. Okay, Krusty Mustard Improv Valentine's Day show by our friends at I can't even talk. Krusty Mustard Improv. It's improvisational comedy. It's a show for people with a sweetheart, without a sweetheart. People who have too many sweethearts, they never, ever had a sweetheart, which is sad. But regardless of your state of love or non-love, 7 o'clock Saturday at the Buffalo Room in Westport. The people on stage, they feel your pleasure, they feel your pain, and let them turn it all into laughter.
It's the Westport Flea Market, right?
Well,
the Buffalo Room there.
Oh, thank you. Yes, and it's the only Buffalo Room in Westport, so it must be inside the Westport.
And it's great burger time there, too. That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, sir.
Happy Valentine's
Day. Happy Valentine's Day to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be eager to hear about your plans. Yes, yeah. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Yesterday on the show, we talked about heart health and how women experience heart problems differently from men. Hear that at KCUR.org/up to date. Tomorrow, the Kansas City reporter who sued her employer for race discrimination and retaliation. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.